tous. Comment il vécu? Comment il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Eh bien, écoutez l'histoire de Bonnie and Clyde.
Okay, I know, I should have saved that one for when we actually talk about the Serge Gainsbourg movie that's coming out soon, but hit stop. Thank you. You know, I saw the movie this week and I've had that song in my head all week, so that's our theme, what the hell. Anyway, welcome to Linoleum Knife. My name is Alonzo Duraldi. I am the film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick. And Dave White is in Dallas, where it is even hotter than it is in Los Angeles today. And believe me, it is hot in Dallas. But we have two special guests joining us today. I'm so thrilled. The West Coast editor of MovieLine.com, Ms. Jen Yamato, is here.
Hello.
And a freelancer whose work you have read at the Wall Street Journal, Box Office, and a gajillion other places, and a member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Mr. Todd Gilchrist.
How's it going?
So, welcome, guys. Thanks for coming in on a balmy day. I mean, I feel like we can't even really complain about this, because, like, it's 100 plus in Dallas, I know. And
aren't people drowning on the East Coast?
And there's, like, a hurricane, yeah. So it's, we don't really get to bitch about it. Hey, Dad, Los Angeles weather's less than perfect. Wah, you know, but still, I'm sticky.
I find it to be very inconvenient. Like, it took an extra 3 minutes for us to get here, and it's untenable.
Oh, my God.
It's making it a little bit harder to sit here and drink my San Pellegrino.
So, yeah, we had complaints on Twitter last time about the cookies and the potato chips. So I got quiet snacks this time. I got chewy Chips Ahoy that apparently have fudge in the middle of them. What?
Oh, my God.
And I got us Jell-O cups and pudding cups. So
they're delightful.
Thank you. Alrighty, so yeah, it is the late summer doldrums officially. We are we are at the ass end of summer, where they are just kind of like pooping out whatever is left on the schedule. So let's start with you guys. Well, Jen just came from seeing Art Idiot Brother, so we'll start with that one.
Yeah, you know what, considering what you said about this being the end of the summer, I don't think the offerings are too shabby, you know? I had fun watching Art Idiot Brother today, the day after opening day, with about 15 other people in the audience who mostly laughed their asses off in the during the trailer roll at Jack and Jill.
Ooh.
They loved it.
Wow.
I know.
I can't wait for that movie, by the way.
Oh, my God.
You know, I think actually it is Adam Sandler's second attempt at a Hanukkah movie after the misguided 8 Crazy Nights. But, you know, I would like to say there's nowhere to go but up, but never say never with Adam Sandler. what do you guys, want to sum up the plot real quick?
Sure. I mean, Art Idiot Brother, the title is fairly self-explanatory. It's about Paul Rudd's character who essentially lands himself in jail by selling pot to a police officer.
A uniformed police officer
who he knows is a police officer. And subsequently, he sort of shuffled around between the various members of his family, sort of disrupting their lives with his sort of well-meaning stupidity.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Now, part of my problem with this movie is that the members of his family are all sisters. So he's got basically three sisters who are, in one way or another, sort of living these lies. And, you know, stoner Paul Rudd has to show up and sort of teach them all how to live right.
He's the wise fool.
Exactly. Yeah. He's the holy idiot. He's the Candide of this movie. And, you know, conceptually, I'm fine with that. But just because it's all sisters, it left a weird taste in my mouth.
Like
there was a real sort of misogynist streak. Like, couldn't he have a jerk brother whose life he fixes also?
Well, his mother seems perfectly normal and
she's a drunk.
Except for her wine habits.
And his girlfriend is awful. She's like just at every turn does everything, the meanest stuff possible, including keeping his beloved dog, Willie Nelson. So, yeah, I just, the whole thing just kind of, that aspect of it really sort of bugged me. But, I mean, there are some laughs. I mean, it's got a charming cast of people, Elizabeth Banks and Zooey Deschanel and Emily Mortimer and Steve Coogan and Adam Scott and Rashida Jones. And, I mean, you know, on that, T.J. Miller I liked a lot, actually, as the sort of other stoner guy. But yeah, I don't know. I just it felt like for a movie that is clearly aiming to be kind of a humanistic comedy. It had a really walloping mean streak about the women.
Hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, I can definitely see that, but I generally felt like the movie had a light enough touch that I didn't feel like it was, you know, deliberately creating sort of a critique of these characters because they were women. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the idea that I got was that, you know, these characters are sort of theoretically more together in different ways than he is, and yet, in spite of the fact that he clearly makes a lot of stupid decisions, that to me that there that the fact that he has a sort of actual philosophy to an extent gave him enough of a character that I thought was a successful counterbalance to, you know, them, even if I didn't like all their behavior. I mean, I think Catherine Hahn is actually really good in the movie, you know, at portraying a certain type of person.
Well, I think any of the women's performances or even the characterizations on their own would be fine. It's just as a whole, and given that they represent, like, all the women in the movie, pretty much, that's where it started really, you know. And even to the extent where, like, you know, you've got, like, Emily Mortimer, who won't let her son take karate classes like he wants and makes him go to, like, you know, capoeira or whatever instead, you know? And it's just, like, it's another male being stepped on by, like, this sort of stupid, shallow woman that, you know, needs Paul Rudd to tell her how to be. I don't know. I just wish either there had been one woman who didn't need Paul Rudd to fix her, or a man who needed Paul Rudd to fix him, I guess.
What did you think of Rashida Jones's character then?
Least convincing butch lesbian I've ever seen in a movie.
Totally agree.
Ever.
You mean those glasses didn't sell you?
No. I mean, she was a convincing hipster.
Yeah.
but lesbian, no. I didn't buy that in the slightest.
However, maybe her sexuality sort of confuses this gender discussion a little bit. I don't know. But she's a female character who doesn't
That's
really
true.
Need fixing at all, and you end up
true.
Liking her, and
she's another a victim of one of
true.
The sisters,
that's
you
true.
Know.
And
that's
also, I would say in terms of the son, Emily Mortimer's son in the movie, like I feel like that's more a byproduct of like two parents who are douchebags than it is of her specifically.
That's
because,
true.
Because it seems like everything in their relationship is defined by Steve Coogan's character,
yeah,
not by her.
And he is unquestionably the awfulest person in the movie.
Yeah, you know, and so I feel like that behavior or that sort of, you know, belief system where they're like, oh, we don't want him to, you know, do this or that, like, is more about how oppressive Steve Coogan's character
sure.
is than,
no,
the,
I'll
you know,
that.
So.
And, you know, the movie, there are a ton of references to Peter Sellers. Like, there's a lot of, you know, where Paul Rudd and the nephew watch these clips from the Pink Panther movies. And so, obviously, they're really trying to set up the Paul Rudd character in being along the lines of
Chauncey Gardner,
exactly. Yeah, like, you know, somebody who's sort of untouched by the world and kind of changes things for people who have gotten sort of mired in their day-to-day, you know, garbage.
And, you know, it's interesting because I love being there. I think it's, like, really funny and a really great movie. But movies like this can be, like, just total poison for me because I get tired of the stupidity of characters. And I didn't... The thing that I was surprised about was the fact that I didn't feel like this character ever got that way for me. Like, his behavior is certainly stupid, but I never felt like it was a byproduct of, say, you know, look at a more recent movie like... I like Dinner for Schmucks or something like
right.
that, where you're like, this guy is making stupid decisions that no person could possibly
right.
ever make.
Only a lazy screenwriter would come up with. Not
well,
yeah.
He's not actually stupid in My Idiot Brother. He sort of reveals his true self.
Yeah.
Eventually in the movie.
Yeah, no, I mean he's just sort of, you know, naive and, you know, thinks
but, like,
the best of people.
Purposefully naive.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like I said, he's sort of the holy fool, I guess. But I given all that it had going for it, I just wish I had enjoyed it more. Even the sexism aside, I think it could have been funnier, it could have been sharper. What I find really strange is that it was co-written by a woman and a woman who is like a managing editor of Vanity Fair.
Right, with her brother.
Yeah. I think she wrote it with somebody else who wasn't. Her brother directed it.
Oh, she wrote it with her husband and her brother directed it?
Yes. Okay. That was the husband. I didn't know. Yeah. Yeah, Jesse Peretz, who was a member of the Lemonheads and who directed The Chateau, I know, with Paul Rudd, and something before that, he had like a big Sundance premiere, some sort of gloomy movie about a couple. I forget. You can IMDb him. I can't remember off the top of my head. Anyway, and then his sister Evgenia Peretz, or if that's how you pronounce it, or Eugenia, who's a managing editor at Vanity Fair, and so they got to shoot at Vanity Fair, but this movie doesn't make Vanity Fair look very good. I mean, like, Elizabeth Banks has been writing about moisturizer. She finally gets a big break to like interview some socialite, and all the magazine wants her to do is get the dirt that the socialite doesn't want to talk about. And then when Paul Rudd sort of gets it by accident, just by being nice to her, and she wants to run the story, the magazine is perfectly willing to do it until like the lawyer finally tells them that they can't. So it's like, you know, it's bad enough that she's making women look bad, but she's making her day job look bad too, I think.
It was definitely not a flattering portrait of, I mean, like really of what, but I also think that that's, I mean, while sort of factually I think that it is unflattering, I think that it's supposed to be reflective of it's sending this character in a direction that she does not even want to go in. You know, I mean, I think that's what it's supposed to be more reflective.
I guess.
Yeah. Although, but, you know, I could understand.
She seems perfectly happy to do it, though, given the opportunity.
Well, what I find interesting is that Peretz being basically that character in real life on some level, Elizabeth Banks' character is like the worst of the three sisters.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Only her therapist knows for sure. So, yeah, you know, already a brother. Could have been better, could have been worse, I guess. What else? Oh, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, remake of the 1973 TV movie, which just got reissued by Warner Archive in a remastered disc and has a commentary featuring my friend Sean Abley. Hmm. New version is, they're very much pushing Guillermo del Toro, but he did not direct it. It's a guy named Troy Nixie, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Del Toro was the co-writer and producer.
Yeah, Nixie made a short film called Latchkey's Lament, which I saw, and it was a very understandable choice to get him to do it, because it's all about, like, sort of that, you know, like, it's a movie like Nine a little bit. I mean, it's a short
film. Animated Nine.
Yeah, the Animated Nine. Where it has these
not the Kate Hudson one. Yeah.
it's just like not yeah. But no, but
Guido.
He was a very understandable choice as a director.
Well, okay. Isn't his background in comics as well, Nixie?
That I don't know.
You know, it's even though Nixie technically directed it, I have been getting the feeling from in the months that they've been promoting it and talking about it that Del Toro is the creative vision behind this whole thing. He was on set doing what sounds like practically directing.
So he's like the Steven Spielberg to this Poltergeist, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very nice that he's giving Troy Nixie a springboard, you know? But
Visually, it has a lot of Del Toro trademarks. The creatures in it are
visually,
very...
story-wise, Del Toro was on set helping the actors.
Really?
Okay.
Well, and yeah, because he was definitely the featured player. Like when it screened at closing night of the LA Film Festival. I don't even know if Troy Nixie was on stage, because it was like Del Toro and Katie Holmes and I think the kid, and that was it.
Yeah, and I went to the set of the movie in Melbourne like 2 years ago, which I had actually forgotten about by the time I watched it. But we essentially hung out with Guillermo for a good part of the time that we were there, in the sense that like he was around.
Are you one of those junket guys who refers to people by their first name?
I don't know. I guess I am.
Has Guillermo been to your house?
Certainly not.
Then he's not Guillermo.
Okay. Well,
I'm just giving you a hard time.
Yeah.
This is one of those things that drives me nuts.
Well,
anyway, you were in Melbourne.
So, yeah. No, but no, he was there much more than Troy Nixie ever was.
Interesting.
I mean, we did interview Troy, so it wasn't like it was a situation where he was sort of kept
elsewhere.
What do you mean he was there more than Troy Nixie? He was among the journalists?
Yeah, he was hanging out around where our little group was much more.
Well, he might have had more free time than the hardworking director, who knows.
Well, regardless, this is a movie that I feel like a lot of people who saw the original 1973 made-for-TV version were really looking forward to because they remember it scaring the shit out of them as kids.
This is and a clean podcast. Oh! It's okay. We'll
I'm
fix
so
it.
Sorry.
No worries.
The poop out of them. As children.
Yes. Well, and including Del Toro, apparently. I just read that he saw it as a kid, and which I find really interesting because... I was thinking, oh, well, this fits so thematically with so much of his stuff. And now I realize, oh, well, maybe so much of his stuff fits thematically with original Who's Afraid of the Dark, you know. Because, again, like Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone, it's, you know, child's point of view and, you know, the sort of the Baroque kind of creature style that he always brings to it and stuff. But, you know, it's a generally effective movie, I think. I mean, for me, the only issue is that, like, to do a Haunted House movie, you have to really be smart about explaining why they don't leave the house.
The humans.
You know, like when the walls start bleeding and like something in the grate is calling you by your first name, like, get out of the house!
And it says,
you know?
Get out.
Exactly.
Well, in this case, the reason is because the person who encounters these little creatures is this girl who's totally ignored by her father
Guy Pearce, to begin with.
She kind of doesn't really have a friendly relationship with Katie Holmes, who plays Guy Pierce's girlfriend, and she's just generally ignored by everybody in her life.
That is part of it, but I mean, but then also you know, when you have like the caretaker getting, you know, horribly mangled or whatever it happens to him, it's like, I don't know. You know, like The Haunting in Connecticut, which was a lame movie, at least it was like, well, look, they could barely afford to move into the house in the first place. They certainly can't afford to leave it. You know, like that, they at least kind of threw that in and it felt, you know, like, okay, well, at least we have an explanation. You know, where The Haunting, they're there specifically to observe what's going on in the house, you know. But, like, that's what I liked about Insidious, was that they actually leave the house, you know, which it turns out didn't help, but, you know, at least they did it. So, but apart from that, I you know, I think this is... the movie that it reminded me of, and it's not nearly as good as, is The Others.
Interesting.
I thought it had that kind of flair. There's what is going on in Spain these days with the horror movies? Like, that's become like this new sort of hotbed of things, like Wreck and The Orphanage and, you know, the Others. I mean, like, for the last like decade or so, there's been like this Spain has been like this new kind of like horror place, and I honestly don't know what that's about. Like, I'd be curious what sort of sociological post Franco whatever is, what's in the water over there that's making all this happen.
I feel like, honestly, I think it's probably just sort of an aesthetic evolution in the sense that, you know, when sort of Japanese or Asian horror sort of, you know, bled over to American shores, there was like an interest in some quality in there that I feel like was maybe never fully sort of determined, which is why like it kind of went away again, because people started looking at it as only about like girls with, you know, pale girls with wet hair.
Right.
And there are certainly many different permutations of sort of Asian horror.
Do you think Spanish horror is just having its moment?
I think it's kind of just having its moment. I also think that there's a degree to which Guillermo, in particular, has been able to... Would you stop it? What am I supposed to call him?
Del Toro. Just call him Del Toro. All right.
I don't even know this person in any way, and that's why
first name is weird. That's the I'm just taking the piss.
Mr. Gilchrist.
I think that he has been able to popularize sort of the aesthetic of...
Sure.
You know, I mean, he, if I'm not mistaken, was like executive producer or producer on The Orphanage.
I believe he was, which was another first-time director.
Yeah, and it was sort of because of his shepherding that movie was seen as much as it was.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And, you know, I also think that he has a style that, quite frankly, right now is kind of like a cousin of sort of the spectacle that like many American movies have. Like, I mean, he has a very sort of muscular like set design.
Sure.
And I think that is something that people are sort of responding to. Although I would say it's sort of happening concurrently with this like super low budget independent horror element that's happening at the same time.
Well, as a distinction, Mr. Del Toro is not Spanish,
He's Mexican, but true. But I know, but like both Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth mm-hmm. were shot in Spain, mm-hmm. so we sort of technically count those. But yeah, no, I mean like Kronos, I know was originally he did in Mexico, and a lot of his early stuff is from there. Yeah, no, but he and I was just telling these guys I got to see the new Pedro Almodovar movie that's going to open in October, and it's not of a piece necessarily with these, but it is a horror film in a lot of ways, and it's a real departure for him. So it'll be interesting to see how that sort of adds to the conversation, just because I know there's been a lot of these movies of late, you know, like because Rec got remade here as what.
Quarantine,
right.
And there has a sequel as well.
There's a Rec 2, and there's, you know, there's even actually, I saw a trailer, I don't think it'll ever open here, but you know how there's like Date Movie and Epic Movie and all those? They actually made one called Spanish Movie.
What?
That opened in Spain, and it's all a parody of like these Spanish horror movies. Yeah.
I wonder if I would even know what to do with that movie.
I saw the trailer online, and I got about 80% of the references, mm-hmm. you know. But like some of them were like, I have no idea what that is, you know. But that was just
That would be a fascinating like sociological experiment.
Maybe the Date Movie and Epic Movie aren't funny at all, but maybe they suddenly become funny if there are jokes about movies that you've never seen, you know. Like
yeah,
as long as it's not. Oh, what's that movie that played at South by Southwest or at South by Southwest last year?
Oh.
With the horrifying one that will never get released.
Serbian film?
Serbian film, oh, thank you.
Which is out, isn't it out on DVD?
There's an import Blu-ray. I was awarded.
And it's being released, I thought.
Is it? Fine. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I just,
but you know, but
things were described to me, and I was like,
ugh. Yeah. I kind of liked Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. You know, I'm in agreement about sort of there needing to be a solid motivation for these people to stay where they are.
Yeah.
To me, I think the moment where I kind of gave up on it was there's a sequence where the little girl chases this creature into the library, mm-hmm. and she's basically goes in there by herself, and she's in there for the sequence has got to be 5 minutes,
mm.
and she's making a lot of noise, and there's all kinds of stuff going on, and I feel like that was not poor. I just felt like it was not well orchestrated because
no one comes in
because nobody comes in to try to help her, and I feel like, you know, no one sees any of these things. You know, I just there was sort of a degree of incredulity that I sort of hit my wall. That said. You know, I really like the end of it, actually. I think that the final sequence, without giving anything away to listeners, is pretty masterfully staged in terms of its intensity.
It's a ballsy ending for an American movie.
Yeah.
I definitely will say that. I saw a review that compared it to Coraline, which was not a comparison I had thought about, but it's like, yeah, I can sort of see that. But yeah. It's not as good as Coraline, but... It's, you know, yeah, I think this movie could have been better, but what's there is worth looking at.
Yeah, I was still scared by it because I do appreciate that it's not very gory. It's an R-rated film, rated R for, I think, violence and terror.
Right.
Emphasis on the terror, for me, at least.
Well, any horror movie that's about teeth and the harvesting thereof is already kind of... It's like teeth and eyes are the things you don't want to think about.
The creatures in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark are these, what are they, like a foot tall maybe?
No, they're less about than 2 feet tall.
2 feet tall.
Yeah.
They reminded me of the teeth fairy, the tooth fairies in Hellboy.
Ooh.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
The creature design seemed similar to me. But you're right, anything that demands teeth. It's so creepy.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is the movie was originally supposed to be PG-13,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it got an R anyway. And one of the things that the MPAA is very particular about not liking is children in peril.
Mm.
And what I feel like they did in order to sort of stave off getting an R rating was make the little girl less fearful. And I feel like that kind of backfires, particularly in the scene that I was talking about, because there seems to be some real inevitability that this girl's going to get taken away in this particular scene, and yet she's just kind of like annoyed throughout the whole scene, I felt like.
I don't know if I would agree with that, because do you think they would really plan for that and write it in that way? I would sort of attribute it more to Bailey Madison's performance, maybe.
I mean, I think that if they, I mean, I think that it's, I think it's entirely possible that they were like, if she's less scared, then we can probably get away with more.
But they didn't, and Del Toro was like perfectly fine with the R rating.
Yeah, but I know that they were always hoping to get a PG-13
right.
to increase its, and I know that that is because that is a because that that particular idea of children being in peril is such a sensitive subject that they may have done that preemptively. I mean, they may have encouraged her in that way, but
one name I want to throw out because it was one that popped up that I had not heard in a long time is Matthew Robbins. Who co-wrote with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
He wrote, like, the Sugarland Express. Like, this guy has been around.
Wow.
He wrote and directed Batteries Not Included. And I think he wrote Harry and the Hendersons. Like, he and Spielberg go way back to, like,
well, did he maybe write the 70s. Original?
I don't know. He did not, actually. Okay. I checked. Yeah, okay. So it was just, I remember seeing his name in the credits going, Matthew. Like, I had literally not thought of Matthew Robbins in a good 20 years. So he's probably like in his 60s, 70s. No, what am I saying? Like, say, 70s. And still, you know, out there. So that was, I thought that was kind of cool.
You know, I also felt like there were moments where I felt like they were either, because of logistic or budgetary reasons, they were not able to sort of fully render a scene in the way, not like visually, but for example, there's a scene where she's taking a bath and these creatures come to terrorize her. And the idea is pretty clear that, again, they want to take her away. And yet, inexplicably, they're climbing up this shower curtain and, like, just kind of shaking it. And, like, I can imagine the filmmakers going, well, this will be a really cheap way for us to, like, create a scary scene as opposed to them climbing in the thing and trying to attack
her. But I think, you know, I'm of the school that it's always scarier when you can't see them. So I think seeing them through that white curtain and, like, billowing around is scarier than them, a bunch of CG things crawling into the bathtub directly.
Well, especially when, you know, they have, like, razors in their hands.
Right.
Well, I kind of like that scene.
I mean, I know what you mean. Plot-wise, it doesn't make sense. Like, they should just go straight for it and not be all,
you know,
shilly-shallying. But I think that that's, I mean, granted, I'm a wuss when it comes to horror, but I like the suggestion of the menace more than the seeing it full on.
And I think the cheaper scare is the one where Bailey Madison is crawling through the bed sheets trying to find what's in the bed.
Oh, that scared
the
crap,
which was included in the trailer, which we saw at Comic-Con, is that right?
We saw it many times.
At one of the conventions.
Yeah, I'd seen it in the trailer, no less scary in the actual movie, though. I was like, ah.
You know exactly what's going to, you know that there's going to be that big scare.
Yeah.
And even that, it's still effective.
Yeah. Well, I sort of further along those lines, I think then the problem with the movie is that it doesn't quite know when to reveal the creatures. Because it sort of reveals them early and then doesn't, and it just sort of goes back and forth with, like, how much they want to show them, to the point where it's like, well, it's either scary because it's here or it's scary because it's not, and but they don't seem...
Yeah, once you pass the line, you can't go backwards.
Yeah, and that was kind of an issue for me, where, again, it's like, by that point, we know what these things look like. They have been out in the open for us.
Right.
And so, it's I agree with you that you can do a less is more approach, and it can traditionally be more effective, but I didn't quite feel that way.
Once you've shown your hand, you kind of have to commit to that, so fair enough. Okay. Columbiana. Which, just as a warning, Linoleum Knife listeners, we'll be talking about again next week because Dave White and I have to have words about this because we're not exactly on the same page. But,
oh, really?
Yeah, because he saw it again. His mom wanted to go. His mom wanted to see it, and he said he found even more crazy details the second time.
Really?
Like, apparently, when she's in the police station in Bakersfield with the French police officer.
Oh yeah.
Apparently, next to his desk there are these binders, and on the side, or somebody has put the word "crime files."
That sounds great.
That is that officer's private crime file.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So my take on Columbiana is it's a terrible movie, but people should see it. But they should only see it in either theaters that serve alcohol or theaters where yelling back at the screen is not only allowed but encouraged. Because
it is hilarious.
It's hilarious. But I think where I've been differing on people is, how in on the joke do you think this movie is?
I don't think it is.
I don't think it is either.
No.
The worst parts of Columbiana, which, to set it up, is about Zoe Saldana, who is basically Matilda from The Professional, all grown up in a way. Out for revenge against the drug cartel head who murdered her family.
In front of her.
Her method of revenge is to become a serial killer.
Right. Hired serial killer.
Killing terrible people.
Right, yes.
Never, in order to get media attention, which is like the most...
circuitous, yeah. Her whole thing is like, I'm going to draw this rare orchid on their chests in lipstick, and eventually that's going to get released to the media, and then the bad drug dealer guy will know that I am coming for him. You know, so yeah, at the age of 8, you know, she makes it to America, she escapes the customs of the Miami airport, hops a bus to Chicago, arrives at her, like, you know, thuggy uncle's apartment and tells him, I want to be a killer. Can you help me? And he basically, like, trains her to become a killer.
Thank goodness those years of growing up in Chicago got rid of that horrible accent for this poor girl. Terrible accent. Oh my god.
So yeah, it's this. I almost wanted it to be campier because like I laughed a lot in this movie, but it's not. It wasn't like full tilt boogie insane in the way that I really wanted it to be. Like it's not quite Showgirls. It's maybe Glitter, but it's still, you know, it's nuts.
Glitter made me cry. So yes, the action's amazing. Well, everything else is just so silly.
Well, the interesting thing is that I was kind of okay with it. I mean, I didn't have like a strong enjoyment, but I was fine with it for a long time because I was like, well, yeah, this is still like basically as soon as it started like a parkour run.
Yeah, in a Catholic schoolgirl uniform.
With like a 5-year-old, I was like, all right, well, this is what this is, you know. And I'm totally okay with that because I knew what I was getting into. And I said this to you, and you didn't really agree, but the moment that I kind of signed off was when the movie decided that it thought that it was really intelligent, and in particular, the idea that the FBI apparently has a technology which allows them to search a database of infinite photographs and
find
digitally
a match.
Map people's body parts to verify like a hand in this picture is the same as the hand in this picture. And then on top of that, to create a convergence of events where a picture through like the most serendipitous circumstances of maybe of all time ends up in the police database. It is like just absolutely...
There are a lot of serendipitous circumstances in this movie. Like she's supposed to be this amazing hired killer and you can tell that all of the things where she like sneaks in and does the kill and gets out, you know, they're very proud of themselves. Like, oh, she's so great. But so much of it involves like chance and luck and coincidence. It's like, this is not a very good plan. Like you just got lucky.
I think she's the most ingenious criminal mastermind in the world, because she plans ahead so far, so many steps
seemingly
ahead.
Every contingency, and she manages to slip that full body, what our friend James Rocky called her murder-tard.
I called it a murder onesie.
Yeah, exactly. It's a full body sort of ninja murder suit under this like tight slutty dress that she gets arrested in after she like DUI plows into a police car. And I'm sorry, if you DUI plow into a police car, do you think they let you go the next day? Without even, well, like, she doesn't even go before a judge. Like, they literally like, okay, yeah, see ya, you know?
Well, I mean, they have other problems to deal with. And this guy, the chief of police in this department is clearly not from America. So maybe he doesn't do things exactly by the book.
And, of course, no one ever suspects her as being the killer because when they're, like, narrowing down all the suspects who were in the building at the time and her name comes up, the FBI guy goes, we're not looking for a woman. It's not possible.
It can't be possible.
It can't
be.
Oh.
He says it in like 3 different scenes.
Yeah, and he's British, by the way, as it turns out.
Oh yeah,
he actually hides it well, as opposed to the CIA agent, who you can totally tell is British. You know.
Oh my God, can we talk about Cliff Curtis's accent? I like Cliff Curtis a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
He is basically channeling Scarface.
He's the new Anthony Quinn. Like, he'll be any ethnicity that you want him to be, you know, and he'll just work
it. I just love this. I mean, the thing is, I love the scene where he just shoots a car
in front of a preschool
in broad daylight, and none of the witnesses say anything. The cops show up, and he walks away.
And the thing that's amazing is, it's not even, if they had said he shoots, and then, like, the cops are coming, and they leave, I would, like, that would be one thing, but the cops are there.
And
they show up, they're, like, interrogating people, practically, and he's just like, I think it's time for us to go. Yeah. And they like, what? They're like, you want a snow cone? Like,
yeah. Like, they don't run off. They amble. You know. Yeah. I don't think this is a movie that knows how ridiculous it is, because as I was saying elsewhere, they would just call it Panty Assassin and be done with it. You know.
I think that's a Japanese title.
I think it ought to be. You know. Yeah. So I think the difference of opinion I've been having about Colombiano with people is like, are they in on the joke or not? I say they're not.
I don't think they are.
But it is worth seeing, but you need to see it. Don't see it at like the draft house where they kick you out for texting or whatever. Like, see it somewhere where you're allowed to hoot loudly and often, because you will.
I mean, like, laughing will be involuntary.
Yeah, because I went in expecting this to be, you know, like another sort of Luc Besson shoot 'em up thing, and I was just at some point I was like, you know, and I just started laughing. I couldn't help it.
All of the action is amazing, and Zoe Saldana, I love.
She's great.
She's amazing.
I do like her a lot.
And she tries so hard in the serious scenes,
she's
but
really
the
active.
Serious scenes are the worst.
She needs to pick better scripts. I think she has it in her to be like action, you know, star actress, but man.
I think she's so much more believable as an action heroine than like Angelina Jolie in that piece of crap, Salt.
Oh, Salt, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Angelina Jolie has like twig arms in Salt. Zoe Saldana is skinny, but I believe
She is athletic. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can see like every bone in her spine when she turns around, but yeah, she's convincingly sort of lithe and, you know, energetic.
And the action choreography is really great, like that bathroom fight scene with the towel and the belt and all that stuff.
It's
amazing.
Toothbrushes.
The
thing is, they choreographed the action for her character. For a person of her, like, physique.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think what they did with Salt was they literally just were like, oh, we could still do this with a female character, which is...
Oh, that's right, because it was written for a guy.
Yeah, which is not to say that a female character is less capable, but the idea was that she was pummeling, like, men who were twice her size just within an inch of their lives. And
she's a wee slip of a thing.
And unfortunately, Angelina Jolie does not have the physical presence to sell that.
Yeah.
I do think because of her like dancer background and just her like I think that there is an athleticism to Zoe Saldana that is much more convincing. I agree. She's definitely for better or for worse, she's doing like real acting in the movie. Mm. You know, she wants this to be a real performance, which, quite frankly, I like. And I think that even if you still take the whole thing as sort of a campy exercise, I think you can like parse out her performance, and I think it's a genuinely good performance.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I did want to go back. You had mentioned sort of the idea of like Luc Besson's movies being these like shoot 'em ups, but if you go back, basically. Even as far back as The Professional, but particularly once you get to the Fifth Element, you know, his sense of humor is sort of bears out the Jerry Lewis, the French love Jerry Lewis. I mean, it's not a very indelicate balance of complete silliness.
Yeah, Chris Tucker in The Fifth Element.
Yeah.
Enough said, I think.
Yeah, but you know, I think that there, I mean, the problem is that this movie is... It thinks that it's serious, so right. and that's the difference.
Yeah,
that,
if he were making a comedy, we'd all know it because there would be clown shoes.
Well,
yeah.
Come on, just like Guillermo del Toro with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Luc Besson co-wrote and produced this, but it was directed by a guy who named himself Megaton.
Olivier Megaton. Yes.
It's not his real name, by the way.
He named himself.
We hang out all the time, by the way.
Apparently, he was he was born on the 20th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. So whatever. I think that, you know, his films are all Megaton bombs, but whatever. Uh-huh. One last thing: if my predictions hold up and Colombiana does become a midnight movie, and you need, I mean, you'll come up with plenty of stuff to yell back at the screen. But here's another one from James Rocky. There's a part towards the end where the evil drug dealer is hiding in his panic room, and he's on the walkie-talkie trying to find his second in command, and he goes, "Marco,
Polo,
Marco," and exactly, James goes, "Polo."
Man.
All right, DVD picks of the week. What do we got?
You go ahead, Jen.
Oh, got it. My pick is, bear with me here, Madea's Big Happy Family.
Okay.
Now hear me out.
No.
I know it sounds ridiculous. I know that you never in your wildest dreams imagined even considering giving any Madea or perhaps any Tyler Perry movie a chance. But this movie is so funny. It's my first Tyler Perry, besides For Colored Girls, which... But Madea is I think I find her to be quite a reasonable character, and whenever she says
hello,
it just cracks me up. Todd and I watched this with like five other people who thought that we were on drugs.
It is my favorite of the Madea movies. I will say my favorite Tyler Perry movie is probably still Meet the Browns, which Madea is barely in. But I kind of there is a lot that I liked about Madea's Big Happy Family, particularly Tiana Taylor as Sabrina. whose way of addressing her baby daddy is along the lines of Byron, and it's like the most hilarious, annoying thing ever, and I think it's comic genius.
Like every character in this movie, she is a caricature, but it is so funny.
I would never have expected to enjoy, but there's certain movies where something breaks early, and you're just like, I am with
you. I'm in.
And that was what it was. I don't know what it was at the very beginning of the movie, but...
It was her.
I'm sure that it was Madea, but...
No, Tiana Taylor's in the first scene, working at the fast food place.
But I don't think I don't think that was even it. I think it was... like Tyler Perry and these like idiotic like mispronunciations or something, like where it just struck
Hallelujah.
Me. And I could not stop laughing. So I support that because I think I do think it's really funny.
But on the flip side, Madea has some really reasonable, I think, lessons to impart.
Well, yeah, as long
not
as
all of them,
as long as you don't mind her sort of, you know, corporal punishment style of child raising, you know, and of course, as per usual with these things, there's like very low laughs and then there's gross sentimentality where, you know, they have to kill off a major character and people have to learn lessons and talk about Jesus.
But you know what I appreciated about Madea and what surprised me about it was that Madea advocates a very sensible outlook on life that is secular, and she's like,
she's a libertarian.
She's like, don't rely on the church or God to fix your life. Do it yourself.
Yeah.
What is it? Pray for potatoes, but grab a hoe. Hey, that's HOE, incidentally, just if we're not clear on that.
Not in the Tyler Perry world.
No. Todd?
My pick is the Coen Brothers box set that's coming out. It's a collection of Blu-rays that I think includes Blood Simple, but most notably the Blu-ray debut of Raising Arizona, which is probably my favorite comedy of all time. I literally think that you can reduce that film to like frame level. You can look at like almost any frame in Raising Arizona and it will make you laugh. And
son, you got a panty on your head.
And the thing is that I watch it and I know every line, and then I still go through it and it just starts like surprising me over and over again. I mean, would you shop at a store called Unpainted Huff Hines? I mean, that guy is so funny in this movie. And everybody is. It's so good. I mean, I think all the movies in there are good. I'm actually not a huge fan, to be perfectly honest, of Miller's Crossing, which I know everybody
else. Me neither.
Most people love, but
I'm not a big fan of Fargo, frankly. A lot of people. Yeah, I know that's a topic for another day. But yeah, I think that not one of I actually the Coen Brothers movies that I tend to like are the ones that aren't as beloved. Like I loved The Man Who Wasn't There.
I think that's the only one that I haven't seen.
Yeah, a lot of people just sort of either forget they made it or don't particularly like it. And I loved A Serious Man.
I did not. That movie I did not like at all.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. I really like Barton Fink. I think that's also in the collection. I mean, you know, it's a movie that I feel like I saw at a particular moment in my sort of movie
development
where like, and it just kind of knocked me out, and I remember watching it so many times and it continuing to sort of appreciate for me. you know, I now they just got to put out like the Hudsucker Proxy, I think.
Cause... yeah, because Lebowski just came out with, like, a week or two ago, yeah, which I've never seen. I know. And I feel like I have seen it at this point just because I've read so much about it over the years. I've never seen The Big Lebowski.
Unbelievable.
Can we tie you down right now?
I just didn't get around to it. And I don't know. It just, I will watch it one of these days. I promise. It gets projected a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I'll have another opportunity.
I wonder how that would color your first viewing of it. You know, knowing so much secondhand.
Oh, yeah. But I'm sure it would not be a good thing. I like to go in as tabula rasa as possible, but you know, I would still give it a fair shot. Leonard Maltin was writing in his column on IndieWire about how Joe Layden, you know, in Houston I just turned 59, and so he's doing this thing where before he turned 60, he picked like 52 movies, like classic films that he hasn't seen yet, and each week he's going to see one and write about it. You know, because we've all got, it's funny, no matter how big a movie nerd are, there you have missed something, you know. Yes. You haven't seen, you know, Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, you know, or you haven't seen, like, Eisenstein's Strike, or, you know, you haven't seen...
Or Rocky Horror Picture Show.
You've never seen the Rocky Horror Picture Show? Wow, okay, well, see, we've all got... Jen, what's your embarrassing
admission? God, what's mine? I know I have a lot of them. I'll think about it.
You know, I've never seen Splendor in the Grass.
Neither have I.
Oh, okay. Well, that's embarrassing.
I haven't seen anything since. I don't watch any movies before 1990, if I can. that's the thing, though. So I will watch out of
again. This is a clean podcast.
I will watch Russell Mulcahy's The Shadow over and over and over again, 1994. But if he had made it in 1989, I won't watch it. I've never seen the original Batman by that.
I would be smacking you so hard if I thought you were telling me the truth right now. Because someone I know who will remain nameless, who was a relative by marriage, once said that she did not like watching any movies that were made before she was born.
Why?
I don't know. It's like you don't want to think the world existed before you were around. I don't get what that's about.
People didn't have problems.
Apparently, yeah. They weren't. Nothing interesting happened until I showed up. So, yeah, I just find that really bizarre. My DVD pick, it's too early for me to start shamelessly plugging my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
No, it's not.
An awesome stocking stuffer, which is currently available wherever fine books are sold, or at least on Amazon. But I thought I would point out that Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas makes its Blu-ray debut this week as well, on a three-disc set that also comes with a standard copy and a digital copy, which is sort of the Disney archive way to do it of late. So,
and there's also it also is Blu-ray 3D.
Oh, really?
The Blu-ray is the 3D.
Nice.
Well.
Finally.
Okay. Yeah. I've still never seen it in 3D. I know they bring it back every
Why
year.
Don't you come over to our house?
Well, maybe I will.
I watch it on a 3D.
Yeah, I just got it.
I'll take a Benadryl. I'll have cats, right?
Yes.
I'll take a Benadryl and I'll go see it.
They'll be fine. They're just going to crawl all over your face.
Great. Actually, no. We should go see it at the LCAP this year when they do it again, because though they do it in 4D, like, isn't there like smoke and wind and things?
There might be, but you are aware of how much tickets cost at the LCAP. Yeah,
it's like
right?
19 bucks or something crazy, right?
What?
I went over there. I went to see something that I think I had to review at some point. Uh-huh. And I tried to, and it was like $23.
Wow. And is that with floor show?
Yeah. I mean, I think they do all that stuff where the guy plays the organ for 20 minutes. Usually much longer than I want to hear anyone play the organ. But yeah, I've looked over there a couple times because there was a point where I think they were going to show like Tron and 70mm. And I was like, well, there could be no better place. I was like, but there could be a cheaper place.
Yeah.
So I did not.
Yeah, no, it's kind of, yeah, going to the LCAP is like paying to see X, like 3D and D-Box at the same time. You know, it's expensive.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's an experience I want to check out at some point. A couple things coming up that I wanted to plug. The fifth and final episode of 50 Documentaries to See Before You Die airs Tuesday night on Current, and then I'm sure will be rerun a time or two afterwards, and I'm on that one. I think I've managed to be on all five episodes, which is kind of exciting.
Fantastic.
And there are clips on YouTube I've been discovering of late as well. Mm-hmm. And then also, if you guys happen to hear this in time, this episode is going to be posted on Sunday, August 28th, on Monday, August 29th at 3:30 Eastern, 12:30 Pacific, Gail Cooper and I at MSNBC.com will be doing a live chat about the worst movies ever. So come on and talk about your favorite bad movies and movies that other people think are bad that you love or vice versa or whatever you want to talk about.
Where to begin.
Exactly, yeah. It's going to be staggering. So come join us for that. That should be a lot of fun. I want to thank Jen Yamato and Todd Gilchrist for joining me this week. Y'all were awesome.
Thank you, Alonzo.
Thanks for having us on.
You can read Jen's stuff at movieline.com or you can follow her on Twitter, JenYamato. And Todd, you can read online at the Wall Street Journal and at Box Office Magazine and in the Box Office Magazine iPad app, which is now happening. And I do a column for them as well called Final Grade. So check it out. And you can follow him at Twitter at MTGilchrist. GILCHRIST. You, of course, can follow this program at Linoleum Cast at Twitter. Like us on Facebook at the Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Share your thoughts and any questions and comments and whatever the heck. Want to thank our friends in podcast land, the Popcorn Mafia, especially Miss Gray Drake for loaning me her third microphone this week. Of course, check out The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, The Podcast, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Secretly Timid, and Glitter in the Garbage. And thank you all so much for listening. Dave White will be back next week. He will try to explain to you why he thinks Columbiana is way better than I do. And we'll be talking about other fun stuff. So join us then. Bye.
Yay.